Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the 2017 Home Education Conference, held in Logan, Utah.
Okay, so we're going to do a crash course in homeschool philosophies today. And we're going to talk about the five major ones. There's a couple of other ones that we'll just touch on, but we're going to talk majorly about the first five. And so if you want to click. Okay, so why should you even care about what your philosophy is? You walk downstairs and you go through the vendor hall, and there are books galore. And you want to buy everything or you want to buy nothing. It depends on your mood at the moment. And so it can be very frustrating trying to decide which ones are going to work better for you. You'll end up with tons of books if you don't choose your philosophy. You'll pull your hair out because you'll get stuff that doesn't work for you, and you won't know why it doesn't work for you. And you'll spend tons of money that you don't have to. Now, let me just say that you are going to spend money on curriculum. That's just it. And some of the curriculum you buy is going to be a waste of time, and you're going to think, oh, I can't believe I bought that. Think of it as a learning experience, and you'll be able to let it go better. And if you can find someone to pass it on to, that's great. If not, then I have some books that I've had for like 15 or 20 years, and I can't give them away because they are so awful. I can't inflict them on anybody else. But I paid so much for them, I can't just put them in a used bookstore. Okay, so what to look for in a philosophy or a method. So these are the questions that you need to ask yourself as you listen to my presentation today. Does it fit my overall idea of what education is in my home? Does it fit into my family culture and lifestyle? This is so important. You pick a curriculum that doesn't fit your family lifestyle, you will absolutely hate it and you won't even know why. But it's because it doesn't fit what is comfortable for you and the way that you want to live your life. And so you need to keep that in mind when you're choosing your curriculum. Is it easy for me to use? If it is not easy for you to use, you will not use it. It doesn't matter how fabulous it is. It doesn't matter how amazing it worked for your neighbor down the street. It doesn't matter. If it isn't easy to use, you will not use it. Are my kids happy with it? That's a huge thing. Am I enthusiastic about using it? Is this something that somebody else recommended and you look at it and you go, but you know, it comes so highly rated, maybe I should choose it. You have to keep that in mind. Am I willing to follow through on all aspects of the philosophy? If not, why not? What is it about the philosophy that I'm not happy with or not don't feel is important? And will I use something else to fill the gaps? So if you're choosing a philosophy, you need to decide what that fills in your homeschool. Does this philosophy require me to learn skills I don't have? So if you have, like, there's some math programs in particular that if you don't understand math and know it well, you're not going to be able to use that curriculum just because you don't know enough to be able to teach it. So are you willing to learn the skills that you need to, or do you just have to choose a different curriculum? Okay, so we're going to start with traditional. This is where most homeschoolers start because they don't know what else to do. So it's also called the canned curriculum because it comes in a box. You open it up, and it's ready to use as soon as you have the book. It has all the teacher materials, all the tests, record-keeping materials. Everything's included. Some of them come with video programs. Some are computer-based. It has 180 increments for 12 years, so prep time for a parent is minimal. You just sit the kid down, hand them the books. They do it. You're done. The strengths of a traditional curriculum. Everything's laid out and it's easy to use. All of them follow a standard scope of and sequence. So you know that as you go through the program, your kids are going to have everything covered. You don't have to worry about it. Has definite milestones of achievement. You know when you've ended for the year. You know when you need to where you need to start. There's no guesswork. Okay, and then testing and assigning grades are easy because you know you've graded all the work. You know if your kid got 80% of it correct or 100% of it correct, so it makes grading easy. Transcripts for college are available through some sources, so if you really want a transcript through high school, a lot of people will choose this method. The weakness of a traditional curriculum is it's geared to a generic child. One of the reasons we homeschool is because we're hoping to individualize our children's education. So some people may have a problem with this. It assumes that there's a body of information and you just need to open up your child's head and shove it all in and they have their education. Treats a child's mind, like I said, is a container. Different age groups study different materials. So if you have a lot of children and you're like, say you're homeschooling five different children at five different ages, then you're gonna have to have a canned curriculum for each one of them. And so you'll be grading five different workbooks for each of the subjects. It can be expensive if you're educating a large number of children because, again, they're not sharing the curriculum. They're, each one is using it individually. It has a high burnout rate, both with the student and with the parent, because sometimes they're really boring and there's no, you know, you set your kids down at a table, everybody does school, it's set out like a public school is, and so there's no love of learning going on. It's difficult to create that. Assumes that homeschool at public, that homeschool is public school at home. And some people are very comfortable with that, but like I said, it has a high burnout rate. So before using a traditional curriculum, here's some questions you'd want to ask yourself. Is my child performing well in a classroom setting? If you're pulling your child out because they don't fit in with the classroom setting, this is not the curriculum you want to choose. Does my child like to complete bookwork assignments and have definite goals? There are children who love workbooks because they can work through it. They know where to start. They know what they have to do each day. And they know how to how to make it something that, for a goal-oriented child, it really works well for them. Is my child academically oriented? Most of the canned curriculums are very heavy into academics. And if you have a child that's not that interested in academics, you're going to have a battle on your hands. Am I the type of person who will follow through with the lesson plans at the pace of the course? In other words, if it's going to take you 4 hours every day to do that curriculum, are you willing to commit to 4 hours every day no matter what? Does my child read well and understand what he reads? Most of these are very heavy. They require a high level of reading in order for your child, unless you want to sit there and read everything to your child. It requires them to be able to read well and understand what they read. Okay, next philosophy that we're going to talk about. Like I said, we're rambling through this fast. Okay, Charlotte Mason. She was a woman who trained governesses and teachers back in the beginning of the last century, and she created this method of education that was very child-centered, and at the same time, there were several other people that were creating curriculums that were the same type. We'll be talking about them in a few minutes, but Charlotte Mason believed that a child is respected as a person. In other words, it's not the child and the parent, it's the child as a person and the parent as a person, and you interact with each other. And so their opinions and stuff matter. It uses lots of narration. Instead of, you know, you read a book to a child, then they would narrate it back to you. And there's a method of teaching. You start out with just a couple sentences when they're really young, to be writing papers by the time they're in high school using this narration method. Uses living books, no twaddle. So you wouldn't hand them a textbook. You would hand them a book written by someone who knows that subject well. Child would be involved in a wide range of activities. She has a lot of different subjects that are covered in a particular year. But she believed that the young person's lessons should be short. So in kindergarten, you wouldn't even do any. In first grade, you'd start with 10 to 15 minute lessons. At the end of 10 to 15 minute lessons, you would switch to a different topic. And you'd spend 10 or 15 minutes on reading and 10 or 15 minutes on history. And that way, not only are you staying within the child's attention span, and then you would add 10 or 15 minutes to each grade so that by the time they're in high school, they're spending hours doing school instead of 10 or 15 minutes. But that allows you to cover a wide range of subjects in a timely manner so that the child does not become bored or distracted during that time frame. She believed that children should be given ample time to play, reflect, and create. And so that is part of the curriculum as well, is that they do nature studies, they spend time outside, they learn to do skills, also have time to do what their natural age-appropriate behavior would be. So they would play with dolls, they would, you know, play with trucks or cars or whatever it is. She also believed that they should be taught good habits. She believed that if you just educated your child without teaching them good habits, then you were creating someone who was not going to be a benefit to society. And that good habits, and she has a structure that teaches you how to incorporate those good habits into the curriculum so that by the time your child graduates, they're able to do this and this and this and this, and these are the things that they would learn, but it wouldn't be, they're not random, and they wouldn't be stuff that you would, in other words, it's built into the curriculum. It's not something that you would say, oh, okay, now I have to remember that we have to do this. It would just be part of your daily routine. She was a huge advocate for nature studies, museums, and other cultural places. She felt that children learn science best by being out in science, and that children learned art by being around good art, and that other cultural places that where they learn about their world was where they should be. And so field trips are really part of what she believed. The strengths of Charlotte Mason treats a child as an active participant in the learning process. So you're not talking down to your child, you're talking with your child. And so you're creating a relationship with that child as you're teaching them. Exposes child to real objects and books instead of distilling information, as opposed to a textbook, which would take lots of bits of information. You would incorporate books that would go dive deep into something, and as the child is learning into the deep stuff, it's creating an interest in things that they will learn more, even more about as they get older. Encourages curiosity and creative thinking. It's built into narration. You know, as they're narrating the books that they've read, they're talking about, you're asking them questions. So what would be the next thing if you're studying dinosaurs? So we read this book on dinosaurs. What part of the, you know, what part of this book did you really like? Well, let's go find something that covers this topic again. So child-directed. Eliminates meaningless tasks and busy work. There are no workbooks. There are no meaningless tasks where they, you know, write hour after hour on the chalkboard. You know, this is to learn their handwriting or whatever. It's meaningful tasks that they would do. They would write a letter or they would write a note. Developmentally appropriate. In other words, you're not going to teach a subject before the child is ready for it. You're going to allow the growth of your child to dictate how they move up through their different levels of schoolwork. Again, stresses the formation of character and work habits. She believes strongly that children should be able to cook and clean and have good habits of being polite and of good character. It's considered the gentle way to homeschool because the method is so non-pressure. Okay, the weaknesses, it tends to be very child-centered because the focus is on the child. And so if you're not careful, then it can be the child dictates everything that gets done instead of the parent. It may neglect higher levels of study because of the emphasis on fine arts, so you would have to adjust for that and make sure that you're covering everything. It may become too eclectic. In other words, you're doing so many different things that they become a jack of all trades and a master of none, especially when they get into high school. Must understand the philosophy behind this curriculum in order to implement it properly. So you really have to study her philosophy in order to really understand how she thought about children, why she implements the things that she does into her curriculum. But it's a fascinating way. Fascinating study. Okay, so questions to ask if you would like to, if this resonates with you. So am I willing to study Charlotte Mason's principles to use this properly? Because you really have to understand the philosophy behind it in order to, otherwise it's just a regular canned curriculum that you're doing. Does our family love to read, both individually and as a family? Are you willing to read to your children lots and lots of books? Will I follow through on teaching the character and habit portions of the curriculum? Will I follow through on the nature studies and other fine art studies? See, this is a part that most homeschool parents, because they don't understand it, don't really want to get into this part, and this is huge, a huge part of what the curriculum is about. Okay, next. Classical education. Classical education, it's based on the method of education that has brought us through 2,000 years, started with Socrates and Plato and has worked its way through. And so you study, it's heavy into Latin and Greek and deep into history and has a very structured, very academic feel to it. So it's a time-honored method of education. Modern adaptations often are based on the writings of Dorothy L. Sayers. Lost Tools of Learning is the book that a lot of people use to understand the principles of classical education. It uses the concept of the trivium to teach. So there's three steps. It's the grammar stage where they're gathering all this information. They don't really have a place to put it, but they are gathering all this information. So they're learning about lots of different things. And then they get to, and their question, they are just kind of sponges. They just kind of absorb everything. Then you get to the dialectic stage, which is where they start asking questions about everything. And this is a stage where most parents start to freak out because it's middle school, and the kids are like, they question everything. Why do we have to do this? Why do we have to do that? And most parents don't realize that's a natural step in the process of, and so they have a tendency to, we stop questioning everything. But if you don't answer their questions, someone else will. So it's an important stage. And then the rhetoric stage is where they have enough information that they are able to form arguments and be able to defend and support their positions on things. That's where debate comes in and writing persuasive and argumentative essays and that kind of thing. Okay, so questions to ask. Are my children intellectually oriented and comfortable with a rigorous education? Because to do classical education well, it's very rigorous, or it can be very rigorous, because you're learning foreign languages and all of that stuff, and some kids are just not up for that challenge, or even interested in that challenge. Am I up to a rigorous education? Are my children pencil resistant? Requires a lot of writing, and if your kids are pencil resistant, this is not the curriculum for you. You are going to run into all kinds of problems because they do a lot of writing. Okay, the strengths of a classical education. It's tailored to a child's stages of learning, so it moves through those stages, and so by the time they're an adult, they understand the different stages and are able to defend their positions well. Teaches thinking skills and verbal and written expression because you spend a lot of time focused on those things. And again, it's a lot of writing, or can be a lot of writing. Has produced great minds throughout history. Most of the famous writers and people like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and those were heavy into this classical education. Weaknesses. It requires a scholarly student and a parent. If you have children who don't want to delve this deeply into stuff, then you can have a battle on your hands, especially as you get up into the high school years. And it may overemphasize ancient disciplines and classics to the exclusion of your child being able to experience. Because it's so heavy into this, you won't have time to do more modern stuff and also allow time for your children to really delve into what their passions are. Okay, unit studies. Unit studies is where you take a particular topic and you use all the subjects to be able to delve deeply into it. So let's say you are studying frontiersmen. Well, frontiersmen is a history unit, and so in the process of that, you would be learning about maps, you would be learning about the history of the time of frontiersmen, you would be learning the skills of a frontiersman, which would be how to go out there and build a lean-to out in your backyard, or how to track animals, or how to live off the land, or you would experience the food that they would eat, hardtack, and all of that stuff, beef jerky, and all of these things. So it covers all of these different areas. And then you could have your child do reports about the things that they've learned. There's lots of different things that you could add into that. So math and phonics are usually taught separately, and then everything else would be grouped under the unit study. You can do science unit studies, you can do arts unit studies, you can do history ones. History is the logical core for unit studies. So if this is a method that you would want to use, then you could use the cycle of history. So you'd start like with ancient Egypt and do your units on that. And then that process, you would also include the science of what the Egyptians studied and work your way through to modern times. It's very family friendly. The reason that it's family friendly is because you're not using separate textbooks for everybody. Everybody's learning the same ideas, but at different levels. So if you have a little tyke, they're just wandering around behind you, doing whatever you guys are doing. And then your high schoolers would be doing part of the teaching. They could be, they would be writing reports. They would be delving deep into things that the rest of the family isn't, but everybody's studying the same topic. Does that make sense? So it would be geared to the age level of your child, but with the same focus. Okay, all ages can learn together. Children can delve as deeply or as lightly as they're interested. So some units you would be doing, everybody would be so enthralled that you'd spend weeks deep into this stuff. And then others, they're like, so you just barely cover it because they're not really that interested, but they need to know the information. Family interests could be pursued. So if you have particular bents in your family, well, you know, we're heavy into music, so we would be, you know, that would be our focus. Or, you know, we're really into prepping, so our kids would be survival people out in the woods. Whatever your family interests are, if you have somebody that's really, you know, interested in math, then that would influence what you do. Students get the whole picture. Another thing about family interests is using field trips and family vacations to provide the unit studies that you're going to do. So if you're going to go travel to an area, then you would study the geography, the history, the, you know, all the different activities that are around that area, and that would be your unit study. So that would make it a family interest, so your vacation would become homeschool. So you can count it as school. Okay, students get the whole picture. So instead of giving a child, like with traditional education, you would, it's incremental, so they would learn this much about science, about this topic in science, and then again in second grade, and then again in third grade, they would incrementally do that. This, they would study the whole thing. So this is the whole big picture, and these are the different parts to that picture, and you can pursue whichever ones of those you want. Intense study of a topic is a natural way to learn. Think about the way you learn. When you become fascinated about a topic, do you want people saying, well, you can only learn this much today? And then, you know, you have to come back tomorrow and we'll finish it. So it's really a natural way to learn. Knowledge is integrated, so it's remembered longer. So because you're pulling from this topic, you're pulling in science and writing and reading and all of this stuff, it's all integrated. So it helps the kid really get a picture in his head about what you're studying. It can be hard to access, these are the weaknesses. It can be hard to access the level of learning. What have your kids figured out? Now there's ways around that, but that's one of the weaknesses. Record keeping may be difficult, like you're going on family vacation, what parts of that count as school? If you have to do reporting or do a portfolio for your schooling. Do it yourself, unit studies require planning. There's curriculum out there that you can do it, but planning them yourself requires mom to do some extra planning. Too many activities can burn mom out. If you're always trying to make school fun, it can be really hard to maintain that level of fun for a long period of time. Making all learning fun can make kids resistant to book learning. So you do all this fun activity and then you make them sit down and read a book and they are not happy. They want everything to be fun, which can be a problem. Subjects difficult to integrate may be neglected. So there may be holes and gaps because you can't pull everything in either from time-wise or from experience-wise. Okay, so questions to ask if you're going to use this curriculum. Am I a creative person who can generate new ideas? Am I willing to live with projects and messy hands-on activities? Some moms just cannot handle the mess, and so this is not something they want to do. Do I want my family to learn together? For a mom that has a lot of kids, that's trying to school a lot of kids, this can be a benefit. If you have one or two kids, it might be a problem. Do my kids have a range of learning styles and interests? So if you have kids with different interests, are you going to be able to meet all their needs? Do I have a drive to push to finish a unit study? If I start it, am I going to finish it? If you're not a finisher, this might not be a good fit for you. Okay, next. Okay, unschooling and relaxed homeschooling. John Holt's Teach Your Own is a good resource for it, and he believed that natural learning was a natural process for children and that they didn't need to have a teacher, they needed a mentor, and that if you provided an educational environment and allowed your kids the freedom to do what they wanted, they would eventually, by the time they were done with school, have learned what they needed to know. He believed that the usual method of learning stifled or killed the natural curiosity and desire to learn. So if you took the force out of it, it would increase children's curiosity. Children are surrounded by a rich learning environment. And so if you provide that rich learning environment and the parents are modeling it, then it becomes a learning lifestyle. Homeschoolers who favor definite goals but a relaxed learning style call themselves relaxed homeschoolers. So they use the unschooling method, but they have structure to it. Then there's the serious unschoolers who just create the environment without the hard deadlines. Okay, the strengths of unschooling, very little planning. You just have to create the environment and allow your children to do what they do naturally. Captures children's learning moments. We all know when the kids are younger that we allow them to do that and we don't allow them necessarily as they get older because we're forcing them into some kind of structure. Children have plenty of time in the real world and space to figure out things on their own. So instead of being told how things work, they figure out how things work. Children are less likely to be frustrated academically and burn out. Children can delve into learning as deeply or as shallowly as they want. So as they go through their learning environment, they can decide, oh, I read that book, I don't want to know any more about it, or I did this activity and I'm not interested anymore. Weaknesses. May neglect the subjects a child doesn't like. If they don't like math, they are going to be less likely to pick up a math book. Hard to access the level of learning because you're not doing any testing or any assessment of what they learn, then you may not be able to figure that out. Can be hard to discover when a child is just stubborn or whether they're really struggling with a subject. That lacks the security of a clearly laid out program. So to other people, it may look like nothing's happening in your house. And so if that's a problem for you, then this would not be the method. It's difficult to explain to others. Yeah, my kid hangs out in the house for, you know, a couple hours every day, and that's our school. Yeah, that doesn't go over well, especially if you have relatives who really disagree with what you're doing. It's extremely child-centered. And so the child can become very resistant to you having any say in what they do. May be overly optimistic about what children can learn on their own. Even we as adults need somebody to help us with our learning because they know more than we do. And sometimes that will not happen with unschooled children. Can lead to children who are being homed instead of homeschooled. They're just hanging around about the house. They're not really doing anything. And no constructive learning is going on. It's very easy to fall into that trap because as a mom, you're busy. And if you're not scheduling, you know, if you have no schedule, then it's difficult for you to know when your children need you and when they don't. So it's easy to get distracted. Questions to ask. Am I comfortable with few preset goals and little structure? Some of us need to know when we've accomplished something and so we can check it off. If you're one of those people, this is not the method for you. You could be a relaxed homeschooler, but not a total unschooler. Do my children have strong interests in a particular area that you want them to be able to grow and really develop? Does my family have a natural curiosity and a natural love of learning? If you're not modeling it, it's not going to happen. Am I willing to provide structure in other areas of our life? If everything in your house is unstructured, it's going to be total chaos, and you're on the permissive side of parenting. And so that can be a real challenge for your kids, especially as they get to be teenagers. And so you have to decide what level of structure you need in order to be happy. Okay, so now we're talking about the principled approach. The principled approach came from the idea that there are core principles that need to be taught to the next generation. And through teaching those, then we will be able to preserve the freedoms that we have in this country. And so everything that you do in your school is based on these three vital Christian concepts. First of all, knowledge of our Christian heritage, an understanding of our role to spread the gospel, and ability to live the biblical principles on which our country was founded. So everything revolves around this idea. And the way that it works is your child creates notebooks, and everything that you study, the child regurgitates into these notebooks. Their understanding, what they've learned, whatever reading they've done, they write about it in their journal or their notebook, and whatever things that the activities that they've done goes into their notebook. So they're creating their own textbooks, and they are creating their own hard copy of what they've learned so they can go back and reference it later. Okay. The seven principles on which our country was founded is a strong foundation for this particular method. It includes individuality, self-government, Christian character, conscience is the most sacred of property, a Christian form of government, how the seed of local self-government is planted, and the Christian principle of American political union. So those are the principles that everything that you do as in your homeschool would be reflected in one of those values. Okay, so then you would, these are the four R's. So you'd be researching God's word, which means they'd be studying the scriptures in depth and keeping a notebook about their research. They would be reasoning from researched biblical truth, so they would be writing about the reasoning behind it and whether they agree or disagree and how they balance it with what they know. And then they're relating the truths discovered in the subject being studied and the student's character. So as they learn principles about history or science or whatever, it would go into these notebooks. And then recording individual application of the biblical principles to the subject and the student. So again, they would be doing writing about, okay, how would I apply this in my life? How have I applied it? Was I successful? Those kinds of things would go all into their notebook. The strengths of a principled approach is that students learn to think governmentally. So it's very strong into government and how government works. Students become self-learners because they're the ones that are creating the notebooks and they're reading the books and creating they're writing down their impressions of what they have learned. Students learn to apply biblical principles to the whole of life. So you take the things that you're studying, how does this apply to my life? How will I use this in the future? And then the students create their own textbooks which they can use, they can refer back to, they can use to help supplement, you know, how far have I come in my journey, I was learning this, I understood this concept when I was 9, how do I understand this concept at 12 or 14 or whatever. The weaknesses, this may present a very narrow view of life and history because the focus on Christian values and Christian history, especially American history. Like I said, it's mainly on American history. Requires a great deal of teacher preparation because you're creating these opportunities for your child to be able to have things to write about. It's an extremely literal approach to the scriptures, which can be good or bad. You have to decide how that works for you. Okay, so questions to ask about this particular one. Do I have a real concern for the application of Christian principles in my family and in my nation? Is that really something that resonates with me? Is it something that I'm passionate about? Will my child assume responsibility for a great deal of their own education on their own? Does my child like to express themselves through writing? If you have a pencil resistant child or someone who doesn't enjoy the writing to this extent, will probably give you heartburn about doing this program. This type of program. Am I willing to undertake extensive biblical research and teaching preparation? Because you will be presenting ideas and then your youth will be writing about them and creating their own ideas about what you've presented. Okay, so then here's some other methods. Thomas Jefferson education takes a little bit of everything and you decide how you're going to implement it. And then you have Waldorf and Montessori, who were contemporaries of Charlotte Mason, and so they have a lot of the same principles. The challenge with Waldorf and Montessori is that most of them are based on private schools, are based with these principles, and so it's very difficult to find lots of information about how their methods work. You can usually find it about preschool up until about first grade, and then after that, It's really been based on private schools, so it's difficult to find how to implement these methods. But that's changing. There's a lot of people that really like these methods, and so if you wanted to go on YouTube, you can find and blogs, you can find lots of information. They're changing their attitude about it. And then the other method is eclectic. And eclectic is where you just take a bit of this and a bit of that, and you mash it all together, and you decide how you're gonna do that. Now, this is what a lot of homeschoolers end up with by the time they've been homeschooling for a while, because you like this and you like that, and oh, I don't care about this, and so you pick and choose what works best for your family. And so eclectic is what most homeschoolers end up with. So, questions? Yes?
I wanted to ask, and I guess I'm definitely in the eclectic, somewhere between relaxed and eclectic. But I wanted to get your opinion. One of the things I looked at, and I think if I remember right, I haven't read a ton on TJE for a while, but if I remember right, it talks about, it kind of has the same focus as Charlotte Mason on original source materials.
Yes.
Only, and no textbooks.
Yes.
And I've always struggled with that because I did doctoral work. I got married pushing 30, and I was in a doctoral program. I got married. But, I mean, I look at it as, my background is political science, and I look at it that I can't give my kids the Federalist Papers, the Anti-Federalist Papers, and say, okay, understand this, without having something like a textbook to give it context.
Okay, now, here's, okay,
context,
okay, so the way that the primary source would work, and this would work with whatever curriculum you choose, is that what most people don't understand is that the Federalist Papers were read by all sorts of people. At the time that they were written, there was a 93% literacy rate in the United States. So we think they're hard, but that doesn't mean our kids have to think they're hard. And it doesn't mean you have to hand the book to them and say, okay, read this, but you can read a short portion of it and discuss it, and read a short portion of it, and it's, again, age appropriate. If you have a teenager, then yeah, you can expect hard things from them. And a lot of us shy away from using primary sources and living books because we feel like the information has to be dumbed down in order for kids to understand it. And that's not always true. Reading something that's a little bit too hard for them expands their vocabulary, it expands their minds, and allows them to see a bigger picture than a textbook would do. Where textbooks incrementally parse up information.
And I'm not quite coming from that direction. I'm talking about just giving that I'm trying to decide how you implement it and have a greater understanding. Because looking at the Federalist Papers, the people that read them in the 1700s, they understood the society they were living in. They understood.
Yes. So what grade are you thinking to hand that to somebody?
I'm looking. I might do a couple in the 7th and 8th in the next couple of years, as far as maybe Federalist 51, things like that. You know, much broader than a few of the biggies that are fairly short and straightforward. No,
so,
not until later in high school. But I'm looking at Charlotte Mason and TJE and going, when I was in my, you know, mid-20s and reading Luther and Aquinas and even Machiavelli, you can't understand the prince.
Okay.
Unless you're coming at it and saying,
but you can. Okay, but see, okay. So here's what the part that homeschooling picks up on that the public school doesn't, as far as these textbooks, is if you know that you want your kid to read that in high school and understand it, then you know in first grade that you're going to be teaching him to understand hard concepts, age-appropriate hard concepts, and you're pushing that, and so you can expect your child when they're in high school to be able to do that. Because you've trained them all this time. You're not going to wait until they're in seventh grade and say, you've had no exposure whatsoever to a hard book, and now I'm going to hand it to you, and then shame on you if you don't understand it. What you're doing instead is creating an environment because you know what your goals are. That's one of the reasons why you want to pick a homeschool curriculum, because that gives you goals. One of the problems with being eclectic is that every year you change. And so your goals change, and so your ultimate end goal of what you expect for your children to understand changes with every time you change your curriculum, which can be a good thing or a bad thing. But if that is your goal and you want your kids to understand primary source materials when they're in high school, then you're reading them primary source age-appropriate stuff in elementary school and in middle school.
Yeah, and I just struggle with how to contextualize it in the
You're making it too hard. You're making it too hard.
Because I don't, I have hard
so,
time. So let's say you're gonna.
So you want to understand the Federalist Papers.
Yeah.
Okay, so if
Sorry,
you
I'm
hand
not,
it,
not
no, 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 this is,
getting,
no,
this
is
something that I've struggled with for
But see,
years
this is, this is appropriate for what we're talking
yeah.
about here. So let's say you want your kids to understand the Federalist Papers. It's very important to you. Well, you wouldn't just hand them the book. You would teach them, okay, before we read this book, I want you to understand who Hamilton is. And I want you to understand who Thomas Jefferson is. And I want you to understand who George Washington is. And you're doing this in elementary school so that by the time they get into high school, they understand who these people were that wrote this stuff. And it's not foreign anymore. They understand the character of the people who wrote it. They understand the times. They understand the events that were happening. They understand the world events because you've taught them all of this stuff. And it doesn't mean that you have to sit down and say, okay, I'm going to pound this into your head. But if you are creating, like my favorite way to teach history is conceptual history. So we're studying, if we're studying Thomas Jefferson, who influenced Thomas Jefferson? So we're going to study all the people that influenced that. Well, who influenced, so Thomas Jefferson knew so-and-so, and so who influenced them? And so they see what was going on in Europe is just as important as what was going on in America and why.
So we're going to study classical liberalism before we get into reading the Bible.
Exactly. So you're going to so you're creating a foundation for your kids so that by the time they get into high school, they know what they're talking about. They know what the book is about because they have the biggest problem with a textbook as opposed to a living book is a living book creates the environment for the study.
You're talking about the series, the living book series.
No, no, no,
so
no.
You're talking about like just the original
living books. Okay, let me explain. Let me back up and explain what living books are. Living books are books that were written by someone who is passionate about that topic. And so they're age appropriate. Sometimes they're and it can be a classic or it can be a modern book that was written today. What it does is it creates a love of learning and an explanation on a deep level of a particular subject. That's
because
a living book.
Use some degree of Charlotte Mason or teaching
yes,
needs.
I do.
Okay, so where do you find a lot of these living books that work for a fourth grader, that work for a sixth grader, that aren't, I mean, I don't care that it's a hard reading level, but I mean, I don't think they need to be reading something that's intended for doctoral level classes.
No, and it doesn't.
I mean,
it does.
I mean,
but that doesn't mean
I don't care if they're reading a 10th grade book, but you know, college level stuff for an elementary kid, I think.
No, you wouldn't do that, but you would find books that would introduce those topics in a way that so let's say you have a choice between a textbook or a historical novel to read to your child to create an environment of so that they understand the context of what you're ultimately going to be studying in history. So let's say you're going to do the Federalist Papers again. So how would you create that environment so that they understand that? Well, historical novels are a great way to create that environment. And then you can just discuss about, okay, let's find some primary sources that talk about...
Okay, what was it, Johnny...
Johnny Tremaine.
Yeah, Tremaine.
Mm-hmm. So there's lots of children's history books. And then you can say... What is true about this book? Do you really think this happened? Let's go find out. And then you can also look at this book happened in this time. So what other things were going on at this time? Why did these people feel so passionate that they were willing, or like My Brother Sam is Dead is another book written for that time. So why did these people, why were they so divided? What were the philosophies can you imagine feeling that way? Are there topics today in our world that are creating that type of environment?
How far outside of the box do you go? I just read Covenant published a book by Carol Warburton called Petticoats Fly,
mm-hmm.
The Place in the Revolutionary.
Well, it depends on you. Sometimes, my favorite history books to get my kids really started on history is reading Lewis L'Amour. Not only was he very accurate, he has stories that are engaging, and that are boy, because I have lots of boys, they're very boy-centric, And if I, you know, reading Felicity Goes to Whatever, that's not going to fly with my boys. But reading Lois L'Amour, and he's got a progression. If you read the Sackett series with your boys, oh my gosh, it is awesome. And I would start with The Walking Drum because it goes a little bit further back into history. But if you use books like that to create a time of history, and we always think of history as dates and names and places, but it's not. It's people, and people interacting with each other, and people creating ideas and expanding those ideas and talking to other people about their ideas. And some ideas bomb, and some ideas are great, and these ideas lead to inventions and wars and, you know, treaties and all of these things. And that's easy to set the groundwork with historical novels.
And are you starting Louis L'Amour reading out loud in five?
Yes, absolutely.
When are they reading? Usually
about, it depends on what their reading level is. But for my boys, most of them weren't good readers until they were at the end of elementary, so that where I could hand them a book like that. But my boys, Louis L'Amour, he's an author, but he starts like Fair Blows the Wind.
What'd
starts
you say, the drum?
The Walking Drum. The Walking Drum takes place in Moorish Europe. And so, oh yeah, and he actually...
See, I always associated him.
No. Then you start with like Fair Blows the Wind and those books, which talk about people coming from the Europe over to the United States as early as, you know, there was nobody here. And these kind of swashbuckling stories, they're interesting. And they bring that tie between what's going on in America and what's going on in Europe and how they influenced each other. Because we have a tendency to separate all of that using textbooks. And because textbooks take the incremental approach, and so you study just enough of a topic to teach one simple concept, and then you move on to the next year, and then you do it again. But there's such a gap between everything so compartmentalized. Most kids do not know that Squanto and William Shakespeare lived at the same time. I mean, you don't see that. You don't think of it that way. But when your kids, like, I am all about timelines. And so we have timelines up on the wall. And so that kids can visualize what history is and see how people interacted with each other. So that ties in your science. And that ties in all your history and, you know, languages and all of that stuff.
So how are you doing your science in that specifically then?
I am a unit studies Charlotte Mason eclectic person. So that's what I do. But your unit studies, if you follow the chronological, this is what I do. So I take the chronological order of history, and then science follows that same chronology for the most part. So that's where you tie your science in. So biology, it's ancient. And then you do your earth science, which is pretty much Middle Ages when they were trying to figure out how that stuff worked. And then you go into physics and into well, physics is the last one, chemistry and then physics. So that follows the natural progression of history. And so as you cycle through that every 4 years, you cycle through that every 4 years and you start that in elementary school, your kids are rock solid by the time they get to high school and they know they should be reading the Federalist Papers. It's not something that you go, oh, I'm throwing this book at you. Because they've been exposed to the people who wrote the Federalist Papers. And so it's a natural progression for them to say, I want to read them. I may not read all of them, but I can read certain of them. And it depends on the reading level of your child at that age. And so that allows you to be able to integrate everything in a way that connects everything. Does that make sense? So that would answer your question. So by the time you got to that point, your kids understand why the Federalist Papers are important.
I appreciate that because I've had a couple people lecture me on why I should be doing TJE, but nobody really go into.
Yes. So that's the method I've been, after all this trial and error, because I've tried all these, that is the method that has worked the best. But I have 10 children and I wasn't going to do all the little, so this is what has worked for our family. And I have... if you're interested in unit studies, I have two or three classes on the audio library about unit studies that'll help explain how to implement them and why you would want to do that. So any other questions? A unit study is where you take one concept, and I use history. So like a unit studies would be ancient Egypt. And so for us, we would, so in studying ancient Egypt, we would learn about Egypt. We would learn about the mythology. We would learn about the geography. We'd make salt dome maps so that the kids would know all, where everything is. We would create a pyramid, figure out how you would build one, and just give them, you know, sugar cubes. Okay, build one. Well, how would you do that? And then they would have to figure out how that works. And then we would end our unit with a cultural night, which would we would dress up like Egyptians. We would decorate like Egyptians. We would have an Egyptian-type program. And we would eat Egyptian food for dinner. And we would usually do that for family home evening. Smashed together two curriculums. One is KONOS, KONOS, and then Famous Men. And so between the two, the Famous Men series has ancient Egypt, ancient Rome, Middle Ages, Reformation, and Renaissance, 16th and 17th century, and then modern times. And so it's Greenleaf Press is who puts it out. Well, no, it's a Charlotte Mason-based, twaddle-free, and it takes one person from each of these time periods. Well, they've got like 20 or 20 to 30, depending on the length of the book. And it discusses the life of each important person, which means you can put them up on the timeline, you can research more about them, and they how they influence each other. So the two of them together is a good smash. So, but anyway, the cultural nights are really fun. They're really fun to do.
You take a month, you take a week.
It depends. You know, sometimes, you know, like to do ancient Egypt, maybe, 6 weeks or so. But to do the Reformation and the Renaissance, that would take longer because there's more events that are going on. So you'd want to talk, so that would take slightly longer. And basically, they would cover a year, but you would be doing science during that time. So you'd do a science unit, a history unit, science unit, history unit. And so with the science units, the way that we would end them, we would play, well, I thought it was Jeopardy, the game I made up, but I had never seen Jeopardy. So it's our family's version of Jeopardy. And my kids know that there's 500 point questions, and we have a prize that they can earn. And so everybody has to know the 500 point. That's the most important thing that they know about the topic is those 500 point questions. And then we play the game and as a family. So there's easy questions that the younger kids can answer, and then there's harder questions that the older kids can answer. And it also shows their dad that they're actually learning something. like one time we were doing a botany unit, and my six-year-old she was the sixth child, and she beat her five older siblings because she had been paying attention because she was interested in botany, and she absolutely loved it. And so she totally skunked him. It was great for her because I beat you guys. I'm so smart. But anyway, we've gotten way sidetracked from the topic. But yes.
Maybe I missed this, but how do you describe just in general, like the TJ Ed?
Okay, the TJ Ed is based on classics and living books, and it has three levels. You have your core learning, your love of learning, and then your scholarly phases of learning, which follows classical education. And you inspire, not require, so it's like unschooling. And so it takes a little bit of all the different curriculums and just kind of picks and chooses how that gets implemented. And if you were to ask a TJ Ed person, how do you implement that in my home, they would say, I don't know. How do you implement it in your home? And so it can get very frustrating for people to try and figure that out. So you really have to read through their books. Because you are creating your own learning environment in your home, doing what is best for your children. So that's what they would say.
It's more child-driven than Charlotte.
Yes.
In some ways, even more child-driven than Charlotte Mason.
Yes. Yes. It can be. So does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So I like the TJ Ed principles of the scholarly phase when my kids are older. And then I like the Charlotte Mason method of using of teaching, but I use unit studies to tie everything together. Does that make sense? So that's how I'm eclectic. But it looks different for everybody else. But, you know, I was teaching seven kids. I had 10, but I was teaching seven kids. And my first four were 5 years apart, and so they just went en masse through school. And to have everybody, I tried it one year. I tried doing everybody on separate curriculums, and oh my gosh, I thought I was going to die. There was no way I could keep up with everything. So this was a happy smash of what worked for me. Any other questions? I noticed that you had one in the back a while ago. Did I answer that already? Okay. Anybody else? All right.
Can I ask you one thing on the unit?
Yes.
Do you do the mile wide, inch deep sometimes approach on it?
Yes.
Especially when they're younger?
Yes.
That's kind of how my mind
yes.
is going.
Yes. So the first time you go through, yeah. you're introducing the topic. So you're doing fun things. You're engaging them. They're understanding when ancient history, ancient Egypt was. They're thinking, oh, wow, those are the people that build the pyramids, and those are the people that have these really crazy stories about mythology. And, you know, and then you tie in, well, did you know that all the plagues that Moses did were all mythology creatures and were parts of the mythology? So he was showing that his God was stronger than all of their gods individually. And so you tie in those type of things, and most people don't even think about that when they're studying. And so some things you would dive deep. Like, that's a deep concept. And so then when the second time you go around, then you're more in context with you're introducing it the first time around, and they're just kind of getting used to the idea of that there are ancient people. And then the second time you're setting a structure. Okay, this happened, this is when this kingdom was, and this is who Pharaoh was at this time, and all of those things. And then the final time that they go through, this is when they dive really deep. And this is when they learn all of the mythology, they understand all of the stuff that you would do in high school that they only learn once. They do a whole year's curriculum, you know, world study in 1 year, but instead they've hit it four different times at different levels of learning. So love of learning stage, scholarly stage, and so.
You're just assigning additional to the older two.
Exactly, so write me an essay about contrasting, you know, let's go back to Pharaoh's gods that Moses did. So, okay, explain who each of these people, you know, each of these gods were and what their strength was and why the Pharaoh would say that they were stronger than Moses' god based on reading from Bullfinch's mythology or whatever. So that's... And that is the great place to discuss that stuff. And family home evening and dinner table are great places for dad to step in and say, okay, what do you think about, and throw out a topic that you know has been discussed. And they will want to impress you with what they know. And man, that can lead to some interesting discussions. And long dinners. Absolutely. And we do the same thing with family devotional. My husband will, and devotional can last, you know, an hour. It's like, okay, guys, I know we're getting out of school because we're talking about this stuff, but they don't realize that they're learning. Yeah, we
test, but you're not getting told.
Exactly. And so you can figure out what they know and what they don't know. And dad's a great person to provide that feedback to them about what they know and what they don't know, and help expand.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.